Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talk to Martin Asling, who is one of the founders of a new group out of Kitchener-Waterloo called Waterloo Region, Yes, In My Backyard. As implied, YIMBY is an advocacy group that's seeking to be the opposite of the widely recognized NIMBY, which means not in my backyard, which they see as an impediment to the development of more affordable housing in their cities. In Ontario, especially along the 401 corridor, as you get closer to Toronto, housing prices have skyrocketed in the last 20 years. Some places, like Guelph, see the problem exacerbated by a low vacancy rate, which in the Royal City is 1.4%, or roughly half of the national average. Getting developers and governments to build more affordable housing is tough enough, but is a good place to start with a change in attitude. Going YIMBY is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, it's a good time for this discussion because we saw NIMBYism in action in two ways at last week's planning meeting here at Guelph City Council, one development for a 25-story tower downtown and another for nearly 700 units in the West End. Both got stern and full-throated opposition, and the reasons were the usual: more traffic, ugly buildings, ruining the character of the area, etc. Only a few people had the gall to make the point that many of these proposed units were intended for rentals, which is a market that desperately needs more capacity here in Guelph. As a recent Guelph Mercury Tribune article revealed, even people with money are having trouble finding housing. Either they're paying more than the 30% of their income to get it, or reasonably priced units are out of their reach because landlords don't want to rent to people on social assistance. In other words, the market isn't making it easy to find a place to live, and because there are only so many places to live, the only thing that will change that is to create more stock. This is where NIMBYism comes into play. The term "not in my backyard" first popped up in an issue of the Christian Science Monitor in a reference to concerned citizens in Williamsburg, Virginia, who didn't want a nuclear waste dump to be established in their area. This was in 1980. In Ontario, early NIMBYism took the form of citizen groups, formal or otherwise, organizing against new landfills in a move that helped spur the creation of the Blue Box Program and other new recycling standards. In 1920, though, NIMBYism has become more of a frame of mind than a cause. Forget garbage, because anything that does not fit a predisposed definition of what is and isn't within the character of an area meets ferocious opposition. But what if someone was more open-minded? What if someone said, "Yes, in my backyard"? We will meet such a person this week on the Guelph Politicast. We're going to hear from Martin Asling about the creation of YIMBY, what he thinks that term means, and what he thinks his group can do to promote affordable housing where others have failed. We also talk about the challenges of NIMBYism, the specific brand they are facing in Waterloo Region, and what talking points work best in trying to combat NIMBYism. And we will also discuss the roadblocks in the system, the goals of Waterloo Region YIMBY, and how sometimes in planning, perfect becomes the enemy of the good. So I caught up with Martin Asling earlier this week in studio. Martin Asling, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Adam.
Let's start with the basics. YIMBY, Waterloo Region YIMBY. I guess, you know, first of all, what does, in your mind, YIMBY mean in terms of the difference between being a YIMBY and being a NIMBY? And then second of all, why start a group like YIMBY and then put the name on it?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. So as opposed to "not in my backyard," the kind of the phrase that you might hear, or you might hear as a means of characterizing a particular position, where I think the best way of looking at it is when someone says, you know, they might say, "Well, I'm in favor of density. I'm in favor of more housing, but," and then there's always a but. The but is specific to this particular to this particular neighborhood, and where I would characterize it as "not in my backyard" is that I think when you're talking about an issue of housing and how much housing you allow and how you facilitate or block housing in a community, I think this question really needs to be discussed at a broader level, and we have to take into account the fact that it's a broader community that is affected by it. So right. When I think of the "not in my backyard" attitude, why I would characterize some views as that and why I would be against that, it's because it's taking too local an approach to a very, really, I mean, you can think of it as a global issue. I mean,
sure,
especially when you look at the climate crisis, certainly at a broader community level, when you look at housing affordability, I think it should be discussed on those levels. So when people talk about opposing, maybe it's a particular project, or maybe they want a particular bylaw in place, for example, with lodging houses, which I hope to get into later. This should be thought of as something, yeah, that affects the entire community. There are people that might want to live in your neighborhood, and we should be allowing them that choice, because that means our neighborhoods are more inclusive. That means it's going to lead to more affordable housing. So that so the not in my backyard attitude that we're opposed to, why we call ourselves Yes in My Backyard, is that we want to broaden that conversation to all the people that are really affected by it.
Every, and I'm sure you've seen this too, you know, every planning application that comes towards council is, you know, it's about that area, it's about that neighborhood. And that's how it's sort of treated.
Yes.
And there's less discussion on the broader implications of, you know, yes, 700 new units, just to pull a number out of thin air, 700 new units has an immediate impact on this particular area. But we don't talk about the impact on, like, a citywide impact of what having 700 new apartment units could mean towards, you know, lowering rents or having more availability.
And also, I think one of the problems is, so looking at it piecemeal, you can't, you might miss the cumulative effect of, well, what happens if, you know, if we block, or we either block or, you know, delay or limit the amount of housing in one, with one particular project. Well, I mean, that effect might not be as large, but when you look at the cumulative effect across time and across the community, and all the different ways you might discourage more housing, then the effect can be quite large.
Yeah. I was reading about you, actually, and you were talking to the Record about how you used to work in a men's shelter.
Yes.
And so how does that experience sort of inform your view? I mean, what is it that experience taught you that perhaps is missing from maybe the broader conversation, that, you know, that seeing that experience on the ground of people homeless, and from it sounds like also relatively hopeless, that, you know, that you're trying to bring forward, talking about it from a more development standpoint.
So I worked at the Charles Street Men's Shelter that's run by House of Friendship, and of course I'm speaking in my own capacity, and it's been a few years since I've been there as well. What I've really learned there that has translated into wanting to be involved in this this movement now, I mean, there's a lot of things. I think one of the things that really that I really realized working at a shelter. So, I mean, you realize that, say, if you're walking around in the downtown, you see people that you might identify as homeless. And one of my pet peeves is people tend to just somewhat lazily just identify, oh, this person that I see that's maybe talking to themselves or doing something odd, I say that homeless person. It's become kind of like just another word that people use for a person that displays some kind of odd or, you know, antisocial kind of behavior that we identify. Right. And it becomes that term for that. Even in my building, when people were, I live in a condo in Cedar Hill in Kitchener, there was a, you know, there's a sign saying, the people were breaking into the garbages, and naturally they wanted to kind of change their policy, so they had a gate around it, and that makes sense, of course. But the sign was saying, "Homeless people are breaking into the garbage." Well, I mean, certainly, I would imagine that the kind of very dire, very difficult situations that someone is in that might lead them to want to break into, you know, one of the large garbage bins would probably correlate often with homelessness. So it's not, so I'm not suggesting that it's unlikely that, but I take issue with that. Just kind of, it becomes like, yeah, just another word for whatever kind of we identify that we don't like.
Right.
And then, when you're talking about homelessness should be thought of as a social issue and something that relates to the policies of really all levels of government, and they all have, in many different ways, an effect on the chance of someone becoming and staying homeless for a period of time.
Right.
So if it just becomes another word for whatever behavior we see and we're not happy about, then we're really not. It's a lot more difficult to actually solve the issue when we're thinking of purely homeless people as the problem itself. And right. I kind of went off on a tangent there and I forgot your original question, but that's kind of a pet peeve there.
Well, I think you're right. And the reverse is also true too. You know, you can see the cashier at, you know, the dollar store and think, oh, they have a job. They must, you know, have some place to live, even if it's, you know, not that great because, you know, you make minimum wage at the dollar store, but this person can be couch surfing.
Yes.
And that is itself a form of homelessness because, you know, if you're sleeping on somebody's couch, a different couch every week, you do not have a home.
Right. And thank you, because that brings me back to the point that I was going to make. So what I did learn at the shelter, I think people see people on the streets, maybe they're panhandling and they think, okay, they identify them as homeless people. But really there's a whole lot of hidden homeless that you don't see. I mean, most people that are homeless don't panhandle, right?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people that are homeless really do not feel comfortable doing that, right? It's a very hard thing to do for your psyche, you know, to constantly be asking people for money and constant rejection. Yeah. So just realizing that the problem is really hidden, but it is out there. It exists. And I think it made me much more wary of and much more unhappy about the kind of attitudes where people kind of think where, so going to the lodging houses. So lodging houses, in Kitchener, at least it's, you know, five or more people. It's where you're sharing a kitchen. So it's not an apartment building, not a single detached home. It's kind of a combination of the two in a way, right?
Right.
And lodging houses are, when I was working at the shelter, that's where a lot of people had to end up. If they were lucky and they found a place and they got to move out of the shelter, then that's often where they would end up going. You know, there's social housing, but there's very long wait lists for the, so however you want to define that spectrum of social housing. So a lot of people relied on rooming houses or lodging houses, as they're used in more the zoning parlance. People need it. So like lodging, I don't think I remember people at the shelter saying, you know, lodging house or a rooming house is my preferred type of housing. But I mean, if they found a place, they were much happier to be moving out than to be staying in a shelter. That's for certain. So, so sometimes when people are unhappy about rooming houses, maybe they're unhappy with having them in their neighborhood. I think the attitude can be very cavalier, just thinking people can just go somewhere else, or maybe even thinking that they can frame it in a way that they're actually defending the people in the rooming house. And that's not really the case unless you're actually providing another option, you know?
Right.
So there was a rooming house that was shut down a lot in Kitchener. A lot of it had to do with complaints by neighbors. But the problem is I think that if you have an issue with someone else's living arrangements, then we should do something about helping provide better living arrangements.
Right.
If your solution is to take away one of those options, then you leave people with less good living arrangements. Sometimes the streets, sometimes a shelter, or maybe another rooming house that wouldn't have been their first choice. And then, of course, they might be displacing someone else that could have lived there. So, to bring it more concretely in Kitchener, you know, there's the 400 meter minimum separation distance bylaw. And so one of the good things is that when I came to council and talked about that, I talked about how in the Ontario Human Rights Commission considers minimum separation distances for low income housing, like lodging houses. They consider it people zoning, which isn't what zoning should be. It should be about, you know, different types of buildings. Maybe you don't want a factory next to a residential area that's, you know, making loud noises or spouting exhaust. That makes sense. But as far as, well, these types of people we want here, these types of people we want there, and we can sanitize it by just talking about different types of housing. But ultimately, when you're talking about different types of housing with different levels of affordability, you're talking about people.
Right.
You can't, You can't get around that.
And it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, too. And this exists around, you know, areas with where a lot of students, you know, live and make a home.
Yeah.
That, you know, we call them student ghettos.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's sort of a... It seems like maybe it's sort of a feedback loop that if you treat a lodging house or a student house like it is like an other, like a worst case scenario type of housing in your own neighborhood, then that's what it's going to end up being.
Yes. Yes, I think so. And another pet peeve, yeah, is just how we talk about ghettos, what we consider ghettos, like in the same sense, it's become... like when we're talking about, you know, a homeless person being a person that we identify as having some kind of problem, a ghetto has become just kind of a pejorative term for a neighborhood with more poor people in it.
Right.
When actually, the origin of the term ghetto, I mean, starting from the Warsaw Ghetto as what one book that many people should read, I would think, it's about discrimination against African-Americans, all the different types of really government-sponsored discrimination. It's called The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein. Mm-hmm. And it was an influential book for me, particularly being in the YIMBY movement, like, which I can get into. But the question of, and to ghettoize, it means pushing people into a particular neighborhood because they're not allowed elsewhere, like the Warsaw ghettos and like the ghettos of African Americans in the United States. The point that Rothstein makes very clearly is that, yes, the term ghetto applies here because it was people being, you know, forcibly pushed into certain neighborhoods because they weren't allowed in others. You know, right. You had racist kind of racial covenants where you couldn't sell your home to a black family. You had you had redlining, so government-backed loans that were not applied to predominantly black neighborhoods. And then to kind of bring it back to the yes in my backyard point, the talking about types of buildings can kind of sanitize things, but you're still talking about people, right? Mm-hmm. So when the clear-cut case of racial discrimination, when that no longer became so viable in the United States and in the housing sphere, that's when the exclusionary zoning became really big, right? Because you, municipal people that wanted to find ways to still exclude black people from neighborhoods,
right?
They couldn't have outwardly racist policies, but they could have policies that had the same effect.
Right.
And the book makes it clear that, you know, the justification behind it often was still explicitly racist.
Yeah.
But regardless of whether or not the justification was explicitly racist, the effect was you've already kind of pushed people down and made it harder for them to own homes.
Mm.
And then you say, well, this neighborhood is only for home ownership.
Right.
You know, we can't have apartment buildings here. So that just further solidified the already existing divides. And I think it really... the reason why it kind of made me interested in YIMBYism here and now in Canada is that just that insight that, yeah, you can, you know, you can think you're being colorblind or class blind or whatever it is, but if you're dictating the type of housing that can be here and the type of housing that can be there, you are actually dictating where people can live based on their income.
Right.
And that's one of the things that I would oppose.
And you get accused of, you know, saying, you know, taking your average upper middle class subdivision and saying, we're going to put affordable housing here. And, yep. And you can get accused of social engineering. And it's like, well, this area has been social engineered.
Yes, it's been social engineered away from it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then to take your point further is that housing becomes this commodity and people are priced out of the market. And the response to that wasn't to lower the price of the housing, at least in the United States. It was to make credit more available to people who couldn't necessarily afford to cover it. And that's where you get the housing bubble in 2008 that caused the crash.
Yes. I mean, the housing bubble, I would say that was very complex. There was a lot that kind of went into that. And But yes, certainly, that idea that expanding credit is the answer to everything certainly played a role to that, I would say.
And then you kind of going back into like the origins of, you know, where ghetto comes from. NIMBY is like that a lot too. Like the origin of the word NIMBY going back to the 80s, and I was looking this up earlier, but NIMBY comes from, you know, in the US when people were concerned about like a nuclear dump moving into their area,
right.
Or even here in Ontario back in the 80s when landfills were filling up and they needed to find new landfills,
yeah.
And people, you know, went NIMBY, like, I don't want to dump in my backyard, not in my backyard. But now it's become sort of a catch-all. It's like, I don't like apartments in my area.
Yeah. Well, I think that, so first of all, I mean, even when you're talking about things that are objectively bad, I mean, like a dump or waste, like that itself is objectively bad. Although the problem of where you put it, unless you actually do something about reducing the amount of waste that, you know, and that would be the solution that I think we would both want to see.
Yeah.
I would still be critical of the NIMBY perspective because ultimately, if you're kind of bargaining amongst different neighborhoods, ultimately, I think what has happened is, you know, when people talk about environmental racism, is that where all that kind of bad stuff ends up is in the neighborhoods where people hold the least political sway.
Right.
So I think even for the objectively bad stuff, there is an issue with NIMBYism, and then it gets into stuff that's really important that we need, that we absolutely need, like housing, and then becomes even more of a problem.
And maybe this is where it comes back around to you and your group, because those are also the people who don't have the time to, you know, stay on top of city council and advocate and organize and present.
Yes.
Because, you know, maybe they're working two jobs or they've been kicked out of their current place and trying to find someplace else to live. So I guess what I'm interested in as some place to jump off of is, what kind of things did you see that were kind of getting in the way of trying to develop more housing capacity in KW? And, you know, what were some of the issues that, I mean, specifically that you wanted to encounter and try and tie off?
Well, I mean, part of it is just the zoning that exists already. So, you know, I would want to see, you know, townhouses, apartment buildings allowed. And really, I mean, any neighborhood with people is a residential neighborhood, as far as I'm concerned. And I would want to see those in all neighborhoods. I would also want to see so-called lodging houses. And people note, rightly, there's a stigma attached to that. Unfortunately, I think that problem is, you know, if we came up with another term, then people that stigmatize poor people would, you know, attach that stigma to that term as well. So I'm not sure what the solution is to that. But yeah, you know, any type of multi-home buildings, I would want to allow them in different neighborhoods. And that's part of it. And then, of course, there's also the minimum separation bylaw that I would want to see removed. But I think the other part of it, too, is, and this book here, Neighborhood Defenders, which is I mean, it's based in Massachusetts, but I think a lot of the same kind of issues and arguments apply, is, you know, and sometimes people say, well, Martin, you know, you're against these some of these zoning regulations, but, you know, people can always apply for a variance, right?
Right,
like,
right.
There is a process, but the problem is that process itself is very time consuming.
Yeah.
And often involves a lot of, you know, compromise on the part of developers, and it's not the kind of compromise that I would want to see. Like, the compromise would be like maybe one or two less stories. Well, that's less house, so that can make housing more expensive in a couple of ways. And the mayor of Kitchener actually pointed this out. The first way is just that, you know, if you're a developer and you're trying to make money and you're only allowed to have a certain number of stories, then, you know, you have less means of doing that unless you raise the prices, unless you raise costs. I mean, that's the immediate effect. But then the other kind of effect that will accumulate across similar kind of things that are happening is that, you have less housing, the less supply, it's more likely to bring prices up.
And when you see these when you see these developments that come to council, they are applying for a variance. And there's a lot of construction that goes on that doesn't come to council for approval because they are already meeting the zoning requirements.
Right. So if it's a single detached, then it's fine. And I think that really touches on another important point, I think, which is there's a lot of people that are opposed to, say, a development based on in that particular neighborhood. If you look at it just in exclusion, just looking at that neighborhood, they would have a point, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it will lead to maybe more traffic, or there would be, you know, more people around, that kind of thing. It was kind of going, making the rounds on Twitter. There was, I think this was in Seattle, but there was kind of a song to about a tree, about trees that would be killed as a result of this development. But really, right. Like, if you want to save trees, sprawl is not the way to go. And right. if you're stopping from building up, then, you know, unless you want to just ship people somewhere else, then that's what's going to happen. You're going to have sprawl. So, and that's more environmentally damaging. And similarly with traffic, you know, the more you have to sprawl out,
right,
the more people have to drive, the more traffic there's going to be overall.
Right. And people have sort of their, I don't want to say nitpicks because that sounds negative, because I mean, people do care passionately about mm-hmm. certain issues like trees, mm-hmm. The urban canopy, more traffic, things like that. But I do wonder how often perfect becomes the enemy of good in these circumstances, because one would think the priority is to get more people homed.
Yes.
And I mean, there's always going to be more traffic. More traffic is inevitable. The more people you have, we're going to have more traffic regardless. But, you know, what's the greater good? Thinking that you're stopping more traffic, even though it's coming, or putting more people in homes.
Right. And I think that, but the one thing that I would say that is, you know, when you have people that are upset, I mean, people generally, and this is one of the challenges for kind of the YIMBY movement in general, people, for the most part, most people don't get engaged politically. And when they do get engaged politically, it's about something that directly affects them. So, right, you know, these are people that are engaged about something that directly affects them. Like most people, they're not necessarily thinking of the broader kind of effects, right? But that's how it is. That's how people work, right? So I think one of the positive, you can take a positive out of that, because there are a lot of things that you can do to allay some of the concerns about development that are actually positives overall as well. Like, you know, what about traffic calming measures, for example? Sure. So that's one of the things that was proposed. There was a development that people were nervous about at the old, there was a Tim Hortons on, I think, Lancaster. Mm-hmm. And so traffic was definitely one of the concerns. It's right next to an elementary school, and they were concerned about safety. I mean, that's a legitimate concern. And there are things that you can do to allay those concerns that really would be good regardless. It's even more important now that you have more people in this area, you know, right. Like traffic calming measures. My colleague, Melissa Bowman, who's involved in pretty much everything in KW. And one of the things she's involved with is the Vision Zero movement. And that's trying to, you know, having that goal of reducing pedestrian deaths to zero.
Well, right.
I mean, even if you don't reach that target, if you get a lot closer, that's still right. it's a very positive it's improvement progress. It's progress. and you know, things like, you know, slowing speed limits, things like taking speeding seriously, things like, you know, infrastructure that might slow down cars in areas where there's lots of people. I think those could have positive effects regardless of whether or not there's a new development. It might be even more important if there's a new development. So I think that there are things that people can do that would allay at least some of the concerns that would also be good. I think another thing is, and this was in Minneapolis, there is a very successful YIMBY movement where they managed to have triplexes across the city where it used to be very much a single detached homes. And the way they kind of, and what they found out is that it's a lot easier politically to say, like, okay, so we're going to upzone, or however you want to call it, allow for more housing in all neighborhoods now, instead of saying to one neighborhood, okay, we're going to allow more housing in your neighborhood, and maybe we'll get to the other neighborhoods later. But, you know, and I think that's where a lot of the backlash comes in. Because it's, you're still pitting neighborhoods against each other, instead of saying, this is a common problem, we have to have common solutions, let's equalize things. And that's what I would, even beyond the political part of it, that's what I would prefer anyways, right? So, so sometimes there are ways that you can allay some of the concerns about individual developments that are overarchingly good as well, instead of saying, okay, well, let's knock a couple floors off, which, you know, leads to less housing, probably makes it more expensive. The process leads to more delays, which further inhibits more housing from being built because, you know, people don't want to get into that, and they have to invest more money if they are going to do it.
Yeah.
because time is money as well, and that further makes things more expensive. So there are more positive ways to allay those concerns.
And also that Minneapolis case, it makes city council more proactive rather than reactive, like taking it one development at a time, saying across the whole city. Because I'm not sure how it is in KW, but I mean, our South End here is feeling the pressure because, I mean, that's where a lot of the build is. That's where a lot of the available land is.
Yeah.
So you know, they're feeling the pressure and they're wondering why we're not building up more in the core, or why we're not building up more in the East or the West End. And so, you know, from that point of view, I do understand that practically why, you know, maybe some areas of a city might feel, you know, the burden of growing up more than other parts.
And, you know, even without the zoning, so we shouldn't exacerbate this problem by pushing development only in certain areas, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, to be fair, I think that regardless, even if you didn't have these particular restrictions, you know, there would be some areas that would be more popular to build in. But I think then I would say, like, if you see that as a problem to solve, then, you know, maybe it should be more positive, like saying, let's have this out there. How can we convince people to build elsewhere? I think one of the and what the Ontario Human Rights Commission said in their kind of response to the minimum separation distance bylaw. So the logic behind it is to prevent overcrowding, right?
Yes.
And what I would say is, like, you know, what's more overcrowded than a shelter, and what's worse than being on the street, right? If you're not actually providing something else. But you know, the Ontario Human Rights Commission suggests, you know, what about positive measures to combat the overcrowding? You know, what about, you know, if that ultimately means there's not enough low-income housing elsewhere, you know, dispersed throughout the city, then first of all, allow it. And then if that's not enough, then also, you know, find a way to make it more feasible with some kind of subsidy or something.
Well, it's also a matter of problem solving, like which is the better problem to have, more people living in homes or more people living in shelters or more people living on the streets.
Exactly.
You know, one has a, you know, a net positive in that, you know, people have a place to live and the other does not in terms of, like, have people having no place to live.
Yes.
And then being, you know, and then people have a reaction to seeing people on the street sleeping in doorways and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And yes. one thing that I was also going to add is that I think if we take away the ability to just have that kind of reflex where I see all this poverty around me, let's have a bylaw to kind of put it there instead of here. That might force us to actually address some of the root causes. Cause if we don't have that reflex anymore, then we have to think of, okay, so how do we actually eliminate, how do we actually do something about poverty?
Yeah. What is the responsibility of the developers? Because I think they're the big piece of this that, you know, you can advocate and win people over. You can go to city council that's where bylaw is made and decisions are made. But then there's the third part of this, which is the developer, which is, you know, the people who actually build the housing. Because in so much as I think we all want more social housing, government budgets are tight these days, and that's, you know, the line we're often given about why that's. And then, I mean, there's also a matter of whose responsibility is it too, but it just seems like we're not building social housing. The only people building housing are the developers.
Unfortunately, with social housing, I think there's a lot of passing of the buck.
Yeah.
And I think that's perhaps one of the challenges with our kind of system of government. We have a federal system of government and everything. So that might be part of it. I'm not wanting to give up on advocating for social housing. I think that's still very important. And I don't want to get caught up in the kind of either or kind of mentality that some people have, either as a means of dismissing YIMBYism or people that are maybe more like in the market urbanist kind of people that that want more housing and they use that kind of as a reason to oppose other things. I don't think it's a reason to oppose other things. I think you really need to try a number of different methods to make housing more affordable. As far as, so I will get to your question, but I think that with the framing, I think I would just want to be careful with, again, making perfect the enemy of the good. So,
right.
So at council, there were counselors kind of saying to developers, like, well, this isn't really affordable, is it?
Right.
But they weren't actually proposing making it more affordable.
Right.
Ultimately, you know, the question at hand was, you know, is this too tall? Is this something that will allow in the first place?
Right.
And so that kind of questioning, that kind of process, if anything, might make it more expensive. So I think that if you want things to be more affordable, you figure out how to actually do that. So our responsibility as citizens and, you know, council's responsibility is to look at ways to make it less expensive. And one of the ways that even developers that are just worrying about their own self-interest can make more affordable housing, well, one way is to have some kind of, you know, incentive to provide affordable housing. Another is to force them to by allowing more housing. So I was reading someone shared on Twitter. I'm at Martin McScratchy, but at the time I did not want to have my full name, and I'm with that right now. But anyways, I shared a while back. There was an article, and it was by some kind of in-house publisher, just talking about the crisis of in one particular area, I forget where, but the crisis of oversupply and all the. And how awful that is for developers. They're forced to, you know, have all these incentives to try to bring people in, like lowering prices. And they're just very unhappy about it, of course, because, you know, they want to make more money, and that they're dealing with all these projects where they had to, either reduce, the banks were pressuring them to reduce their costs to actually, you know, get units actually sold.
Right.
So I think that that's one way to put pressure on developers to make more affordable housing, is to allow other people to build housing elsewhere and to put that pressure on. I would want developers to build more affordable housing. The question is, how do you do that?
Right.
So unfortunately, a lot of the pressure that we put is actually to make it less affordable. There are, there are things like inclusionary zoning, which would, you know, if a developer wants to build more housing, then they would have to devote a certain amount of it to affordable units. And I think, like, for me, I've somewhat mixed views on that. I think ultimately why I am still, if not sympathetic, at the very least curious and would like to, think about it more is just the fact that, like you were saying, there is a dearth of social housing and a willingness to pay for something that I think is very necessary. I mean, what's more important than, say, solving the problem of homelessness? So when there's that lack of alternative sources, you can't always be picky. But I think one of the issues with just looking at it in that way, while developers should do it, they're the ones building it. If you, there's always the possibility that you might discourage more housing from being built. And if you don't want more housing to begin with, maybe that's fine. But if you recognize that there's that potential, a very likely effect on affordability, it's possible that you could be making specific more affordable units and then making it less affordable overall. I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I've looked at a couple literature reviews where it's not as clear cut as that.
Right.
And one of the reasons for that is that there are certain things you can do, like density bonusing, although that's
changing.
That's changing. But,
there
are certain things you can do that you can still kind of have change that kind of incentive structure by maybe subsidizing and putting some of the responsibility on us as citizens as well. I think ultimately we are all a part of this housing crisis and we're all responsible. So I think we have to have a solution where we all chip in to some extent. I think I like the progressive tax system. I think that people that have more should contribute more.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, we should all contribute.
But you raise an interesting point, at least to me, is that, you know, there's also a psychological cost to this, because if you see the big guys, you know, coming before council and you know, having to wrestle support and having to come back again and again with amendments and things, does that dissuade the smaller developers from, you know, bringing forward proposals that might change the quote-unquote character of an area, you know, to develop more housing? Or more than that, just like discouraging more development, period. And I'm not saying we should like rubber stamp everything, but we've had a bit of this with in Guelph with the quote-unquote Guelph factor, that there's a view of city council as saying as a body that says no first.
Right.
Instead of, you know, yes and or yes but, the answer is no. And I mean, it's a tricky balancing act, mm-hmm. but I think there is something real to what you're saying here, that, you know, any housing is good housing, yeah. In a sense.
Yeah. And I'm not a developer, so I don't really, I can't speak to the intricacies of all the decisions that are made, but sure. I think certainly, you know, people have said that element of uncertainty can play a role. And right. I think this might be a very odd analogy, but a long time ago, I saw a documentary. It was critical of the rating systems for movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called This Film Is Not Yet Rated.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was talking about how basically there's this guessing game where, you know, if you're making a movie, you don't know exactly. There's not like there's this list that's saying this is going to make it restricted, this is going to make it NC-17.
Yeah.
You just have to kind of try and put forward something, and then they'll slap a rating on it, and then, you know, you can go back and revise, costing a lot more money and everything.
Yeah.
That's something that I think we should generally avoid with our regulations, because, I mean, it's one thing that you can talk about, and there's a lot more critique in that movie about the sexism and the gender imbalances and the anti-gay bias and what we actually consider restricted.
Right.
That's a whole other issue as well. Watch that documentary. It's very good. But in general, with regulation, I think it's important to have some amount of predictability, so that, you know, you have the effect of the regulation, and hopefully it's doing something positive. It's, if it's about, you know, protecting tenants or doing something good like that. But even if it's something that I wouldn't necessarily want, like saying buildings should be lower,
right.
There's that added impact of not knowing exactly what you're going to need to do, why and when, how much it is going to cost. And that also has an effect on whether or not someone will want to build housing. And if you want more housing, and I think that you should, I can talk about, like, sometimes there's a hesitancy to believe that more housing will lead to less cost.
Right.
I think the most likely story is that it would.
Mm.
Because I think that, you know, generally speaking, if the supply of something goes down, the cost goes up. And the analogy that I used before is, like, when people are talking about oil prices or maybe some other commodity as well, maybe there's a fire or some, you know, there's, you know, the wildfires lead to shortages in a particular commodity. We take for granted that, okay, well, the price is going to rise now.
Yeah.
If there is an, you know, if there's a shortage of oil, if there's something going on with OPEC, we understand that, okay, the price is going to rise. We understand that intuitively in other contexts.
Mm.
And even, you know, someone that's like, I remember when Stephen Harper was during the debates when he was still running for prime minister, he has a master's in economics, but he argued that a carbon tax would not affect the driving decisions and right. The decision to buy a car or not, and maybe what kind of car to get.
Yeah.
He ultimately tried to argue in a nationally televised debate that there would not be an effect, that the carbon tax would not affect consumption. So I think there's a lot of believing what you want to believe or arguing what you want to argue in different contexts where it suits your needs. And I think we have to be realistic. You might not want something in your neighborhood, but I think you have to just challenge yourself to think, in a different context, would you also believe that having less supply of something would not affect the price, or would somehow have the opposite effect of the price that you would otherwise assume would happen? And we can get into maybe the economics of it. And I'm still learning, to be fair, right? One of the things that our group is doing, Waterloo Region, yes, in my backyard, is we like having book clubs. We had one on a book called House Divided, which is all about so-called missing middle housing in Toronto. That's
right.
In between the tall apartment buildings and the low single detached housing, where vast swaths of Toronto are the so-called yellow belt, where it's pretty much just single detached homes that are allowed. So that was a very good book talking about all the different types of housing that you could have if you were allowed that, and how that might increase affordability. So we're always looking to learn more, but I think the one challenge that it would have to people that might want to look at one study that that seems to support their point of view and not look at the other ones is just, I think what you really want to see here, the question isn't necessarily just, will this building be affordable? Hopefully it will be. If it's new, it probably won't be that affordable, unfortunately. But what is the effect over time, and what is the effect on other buildings? Like, what is the effect of the overall supply? So those are the questions that have to be answered. It's not just, okay, what's the cost of this building? What's the cost of housing in this neighborhood after we allowed for this? It's what's the cost overall? Mm-hmm. What is the effect on neighboring, the cost of neighboring housing as well as the immediate housing?
Yeah. And it is, I mean, it is all terribly complicated once you get into it, like assessment. And I mean, there are newer places in town that are assessed at a higher rate than older parts of town. And you would think the opposite would be true, but...
Yeah,
because of the way, you know, MPAC works, and you really do need a master's degree to have it all figured out.
But I think the things that I would say that again, perfect should not be the enemy of the good.
Yeah,
I think that the best available evidence does still support the view that more housing will lead to lower costs. That the studies that really kind of try to take that broader view, that's what they tend to find, and I think. It is a bit more intuitive as well, like I was saying with other types of prices. It's not to say that every time there's this simple supply and demand story, right?
Right.
But the thing is, like in other cases where I've looked a little bit at minimum wages, where, you know, there's a lot of debate about the actual empirical evidence of what actually is the effects of minimum wages. And there's a lot of evidence that it doesn't have the kind of simplest the simple kind of explanation that it might lead to less jobs and so there's evidence to the contrary, and there's also theory to the contrary. I think one of the positive things in economics is there's a bit more emphasis on the empirical evidence, where it used to be more theory, but also having kind of an alternative explanation for what happens is also helpful. With the minimum wage story, there is that alternative explanation where there's a sort of what you would call monopsony, where there's where those owners have less competition, so it's easier for them to, you know, less competition for the labor, so it's easier for them to not have to raise wages. And in that context, it's a bit more complex. But so there's so the thing that I have is, you know, if you want to suggest that more housing will not lead to lower prices, I would want to see better evidence, and I would want to hopefully I would want to see some kind of a story that convinces me as well, as far as having a different model of how this particular segment of the economy works.
Right.
And so far what I've seen hasn't been that convincing. You know, people are trying to say that the economy is so segmented that it won't really affect at all if you build newer housing that is more expensive, it won't make, because that's a completely separate market.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, most people, if they could afford it, would very much like to live in nicer housing.
Sure.
So I don't buy that story necessarily.
And then, you know, it gets into a much bigger conversation, but, you know, a lot of our economic ideas, you know, working out, just as you said, the minimum wage, or having a guaranteed basic income. The idea is, you know, having a guaranteed basic income means, you know, fewer jobs. Having a higher minimum wage means fewer jobs, you know. But it turns out that the number of jobs almost stay basically the same. What you see the loss of is more people moving from job to job, because people enjoy that stability. And the same thing with things like traffic. People have always assumed you build more roads, it means less congestion. Mm-hmm. That's not the case. More roads creates more traffic. And I think we're sort of dealing with some of these assumptions with housing too, that, you know, you know building more housing means increasing the prices. Well, actually it's the opposite. Not building more housing increases the prices, because you've got scarcity.
Right. I mean in that case, I think that there are lots of different cases where you might not have the expected effects. In this case, I don't think there's enough evidence that the expected effects is not what will occur. The expected effect would be, you know, if you have more housing, you have less scarcity, and it's, you know, more the developers or the and the landlords, they have to compete with more, they have more competitors, so they, you know, they feel more pressure to lower prices. That's the expected story, and that's what The best available evidence that I have seen has shown.
Yeah. We've talked a lot about the theory, about, you know, what we're trying to achieve here with your group. I do want to hear a bit more about sort of like the specifics, like what's Waterloo Region YIMBY working on right now that that you want to sort of put on the radar? What kind of campaigns are you thinking about? What kind of work are you doing?
So the biggest one right now is the minimum separation distance bylaw. And part of that was, I mean, it has the, to me, the clearest effect. I mean, there's, like I said, there's two different ways that more housing can affect price. One is just increasing supply. And the other one is that if the actual housing that you create is also more affordable. So like with lodging houses, it kind of fits both explanations for why it could lower prices. And the other part is that we actually did have some support among council and among city staff. I'm on the Affordable Housing Strategy Advisory Committee,
mm-hmm.
and I'm very much pushing for, so that was actually, that question has moved to the advisory committee. I'm very much trying to keep it on the agenda at the advisory committee and advocating within and without it towards that end. So that's a very big part of it. We would also, I mean, we're also kind of figuring out, so like, where do we focus our energies? Because we would really like to see more housing across the board. The challenging thing is that, you know, the city of Waterloo and the city has a little while ago already passed their new bylaw. City of Kitchener just passed their new bylaw. But at the city of Kitchener, they're still looking at the individual neighborhoods. And I think that's one mm-hmm. way where we have to really have to be careful that they're not further downzoning. At the same time, the city of Kitchener actually, there were some positives as well. I don't know if you heard about the tiny homes, you know, tiny homes and, you know, secondary suites, the granny flats. I think that's a very positive step. But we don't want to, at the same time, be limiting housing in different contexts when you're looking at the individual neighborhood. So that's something that we were concerned about. And then on top of that, just looking at individual cases. So so in Waterloo, for example, there's the Beechwood Cooperative Homes. They're looking to this is, you know, cooperative affordable housing, and they want to expand. And, you know, of course, we would support that expansion as it's more affordable housing and more homes to begin with, which are both good things. So I would also just pay attention. I'd like to pay attention more, but in Cambridge, there's a lot of controversy around the Cambridge shelter. People kind of not wanting to kind of move it. And I mean, ultimately, you know, emergency shelters are very important, and they need to be where people are going to most likely use it. And the same thing goes for the supervised consumption sites. So,
right.
So Kitchener, you know, we had that battle, and there was. And there was some success where, you know, ultimately, City of Kitchener decided to, put it more where the social service agencies were thinking this is where it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
The City of Cambridge has been a bit more hesitant with that. So I think that's something to kind of keep in mind. I think, maybe it'll come up in Waterloo as well, but it's an important thing, and in Guelph. I don't know what the status is right now.
The safe consumption site?
Yeah.
It's downtown.
It's downtown.
It's open 7 days a week. It's at the community health center. So
yeah. So that's a really important thing. I think that, like as far as, you know, what I learned working at a shelter, harm reduction is very important. It, you know, it saves lives. I also worked at Supportive Housing of Waterloo, which, that's actually permanent supportive housing where, you know, harm reduction is practiced in a more concrete way because, you know, people can have their own place to live. And it's very complex in an emergency shelter. And it's one of the problems with not having enough shelters or options for people that are otherwise on the streets, where a lot of people won't go to a shelter because there's too much drugs there. A lot of people also won't go to or can't stay at a shelter because of rules, including around drugs. So mm-hmm. there's, if you try to have a one size fits all kind of approach to people that are in these very difficult circumstances, it's not going to work, because often you're discouraging people from from being comfortable staying there based on, at the same time, to different people being too lax or far too strict when it comes to drug use.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely support the idea of having different types of emergency shelter. Ultimately, I would prefer to have none because they aren't needed. But right. that's not. But do that by, you know, don't get rid of shelters, make them available, and then hopefully make them not needed.
And what's going on with the Cambridge shelter right now? I remember hearing there's something to it, but I mean, just for our own edification, what's happening?
So I don't want to speak to that too much at this point. Just because we've been very focused so far on Kitchener, and we'd like to expand more. But so far, to be fair, and part of that's because Kitchener has kind of made that step with the Affordable Housing Strategy Committee, have put it more on the agenda. I would like to see kind of other cities take that initiative as well. It's not that Kitchener's perfect either. I definitely would like to see that minimum separation distance removed, but I think having that kind of step helps put things on the agenda, and I think that's really important. And I think the media is starting to really pay attention, which is a positive. Sorry, I can't give you a really full exposition of the Cambridge shelter, but I think we would really like to have more and more members that can do more and more work looking at all the, because there's so much to look at when it comes to zoning, when it comes to affordable housing, all the different possible developments, all the different controversies, and also the bigger picture, which we don't want to lose sight of as well, as far as like what you allow in the first place.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of work to be done still, and there's a challenge because, like I said, people are more likely to look at what immediately affects them, and the people that are immediately affected by homelessness, well, they have a lot else on their plate.
Yeah.
So it's very hard to kind of get a movement for looking at that broader picture and looking particularly like how do we help the situation for people that are in much more dire circumstances.
Yeah. So if people want to get involved, what kind of help are you looking for?
So all kinds of help. So we have monthly meetups, and that's a good way to kind of keep connected. We're at the Civic Hub, which is at the St. John the Evangelist Church in Kitchener. So every fourth Thursday of the month, from 7 to 9, we'll be there. So that's kind of, if you want to kind of touch base face to face with other people that might be able to help as well. Oh, we're on Facebook and Meetup under Waterloo Region, Yes in My Backyard. So if you're interested in helping in any way, you can reach out to us. We're looking at a number of different things. We'd like to have another conference. We had a conference in the summer about affordable housing. We'd like to have one kind of about people zoning, this whole idea of zoning people instead of buildings and all the problems associated with that. We'd like to have that, hopefully in the summer, late spring. So anyone that's interested in helping organize events, helping organize meetups, whether it's book clubs, keeping track of what all the different councils are doing. You know, you have Kitchener, Waterloo, Cambridge, and Waterloo Region, and you have the and you have the townships as well. So just keeping track of all the things that are going on, going to council, sharing articles, sharing your thoughts. There's a whole number of different ways. And of course, I mean, the classic, still probably most important method of helping out, which is, contacting your counselor and your council, your mayor. Your own counselor in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really important to send the message to them that there are people that want more housing, that reject NIMBYism, that want more housing, including in their neighborhood, and not just somewhere else.
Well, Martin Asling, thank you for your advocacy, and thank you for coming down to Guelph to talk about it today.
All right. Thank you very much, Adam.
And once again, that was Martin Asling. To learn more about his group, Waterloo Region Yes in My Backyard, you can join their Facebook group at facebook.com/waterloo-region-yes-in-my-backyard. That's Waterloo Region Yes in My Backyard, and you can just search them on Facebook, or you can find the link on the show notes page for this podcast. Speaking of this podcast, that is all for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The Guelph Politicast is recorded at CFRU at the University Center on the University of Guelph campus, and to learn more about CFRU, go to cfru.ca. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, or you can download it from the host Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. And when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you will get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at animedonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at @animedonaldson or at Guelph Politico. There is also the Guelph Politico Facebook page, which you can find at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you next week. And until then, see you next time.